Okay, yeah, let's just get started. So the theme for this year's Sunstone is the spirituality of the rising generation. And I'm not sure we could get very far in a conversation about this generation without being confronted with the overwhelming problems that we'll be facing. To name a few, peak oil species extinction, global warming, pollution, globalization, poverty, the decline of democracy. This panel is meant to break down the barriers between our traditional centers of spirituality. We're not using that. No. Unless our... Yeah. Okay. Centers of spirituality and the realms of economy, ecology, and culture. The church, the Mormon church, has unparalleled social and spiritual capital that could be invested in the solution to real world problems. But it will take a great many discussions about tearing down these walls and bringing moral and political issues together outside the comfortable arenas of contemporary conservative Christianity. So in this panel, looking forward, visions for the future, myself, Jason Brown, our invisible panelist, Oliver Smith Callis, who's yet to arrive, will be speaking, and Zach Davis. Each of us will speak for about 10 minutes. I'll be going first, and we'll each be addressing different issues, and with the remaining time, we'll open it up for discussion, brainstorming, critiques, and questions. I'll go ahead and introduce all three of us at the beginning. My name is, I'll do me at the end. But Oliver, who should be arriving soon, have his bio here, is an artist, designer, builder, musician, and garden agriculturalist. And he graduated from the University of Utah with a BFA in Interdisciplinary Visual Arts, and he's a student of permaculture design. He currently works as the lead accredited professional for the AGAC Architects in Salt Lake. That is a leading the way in incorporating sustainability into our built environment. And again, he's not here yet. Zach grew up in St. George and is currently attending BYU, studying politics and philosophy. His favorite book is 100 Years of Solitude, and he served a mission in... Does that say Guatemala?
Gibraltar.
Sorry. Okay. And again, my name is Jason Brown. I attend BYU as an undergraduate in anthropology. I'm about to start graduate work in forestry in about 3 hours. And that's about it. I'll start into my paper, and then Oliver still hasn't showed. We'll hear from Zach. In taking on the topic of spirituality in our generation, it may seem odd to start with such a drab and secular thing as the economy. But an economy is a part of the fabric of human ecology. It is part of a tightly woven tapestry that holds society together and carries out the consequences of its values. As I hope we have noticed, the dominant global economy has created an ecological and social crisis of global proportions. This crisis is upon us because the values our economy espouses and carries out view the natural world as raw material and people as laborers and consumers. If an economy is capable of holding values, then the solution to the global crisis of capitalism will not be solved by simply rearranging subsidies and taxes or by increasing regulations on offending institutions. The very bedrock of the values of that capitalism espouses must be questioned and, if necessary, dismantled in order to make way for values that encourage an ecologically sustainable society. Many of the values espoused by the so-called anti-globalization movement can be found in no uncertain terms in the teachings of the world's religions. Indeed, it is no secret that the timeless religious values of equality, social justice, and solidarity were at the core of the anti-slavery, women's, and civil rights movements. These values, though sometimes dismissed as utopian, are the core to the challenge presented to the status quo of political and economic structures. Now shifting a bit. The Mormon Ward began as a unit of economic, political, and spiritual organization, a bustling beehive of hard work, solidarity, and spiritual fulfillment. Today its primary role, however, is that of a spiritual division of labor with the added social benefits of a tight-knit congregation. I am deeply grateful for my experiences growing up in a Southern California ward. However, in studying the organization of United Order Age wards and in coming to grips with the crises that we face in the future, I am convinced that the Mormon ward could do much more to meet its full potential. How can we reinvent and reinvigorate the beehive to bring about the changes our society so desperately needs? The Mormon Ward could become the locus of organizing for the revitalization of the social values of Christianity, while at the same time contributing to the solutions of the global crisis of capitalism. In early Mormon theology, there was very little distinction between the sacred and the secular. Work was a path to spiritual fulfillment just as prayer. Joseph Smith was quick to point out that Christianity was not meant to fit only within the confines of our hearts, alone. Our obligation to each other and to the poor is an integral part of God's plan for the saints as priesthood and revelation. The emergence of Mormonism, despite great changes proposed to the Christianity of the era, would also enshrine the social teachings of Christianity through the law of consecration, which celebrates the ideals of equality, social justice, solidarity, self-reliance, and hard work, and brought them into the fold of a comprehensive salvation protocol. Soon after the formation of the Church, Joseph commanded the saints to begin living this law, but persecution made it practically impossible. Soon after the saints arrived in Utah Valley under the direction of Brigham Young, efforts were commenced to form cooperative agricultural settlements. Brigham's United Order Cooperative Movement envisioned creating a society free of competition and inequality, one worthy of greeting angels and eventually the returning Savior himself. Between the years of 1868 and 1884, Brigham was deeply involved in creating more than 200 cooperative enterprises throughout the Utah Territory. From collective farming and cattle ranching to sawmills and shoemakers, the cooperative movement expanded outward from the center of Salt Lake. ZCMI, as we all know about, was established in Salt Lake as a member-owned retail shop, which was specifically designed to keep non-Mormons from profiting and gaining economic power over the saints. In addition to community-based industries such as United Order projects, wards took on various craft and home-based industries. Despite the difficulty of creating cooperative communities, which there were many, in the cradle of what was then an emerging capitalist economy, the United Order community at Orderville is a shining example of the accomplishments of Mormon communalism in the 19th century. Begun in March of 1874, a small group of Mormons who had fled a failed settlement in Nevada began one in southern Utah. The community at Orderville was a conscious attempt by its members to live the United Order to its fullest. There was no private property, and each family was given separate dwellings, which were arranged in a semi-fort fashion around a town square and communal buildings. Members voluntarily entered the order with all that they possessed being consecrated for the good of the community. There was a community kitchen in which women and children rotated cooking and cleaning duties, and simple meals were served. Fruits and vegetables were produced in community gardens and orchards. Other acreage was dedicated to pasture for cattle, pigs, chickens, sheep, and grains. A nearby coal deposit was exploited for energy, and there were soap makers, leather workers, woolen mills, sawmill, broom makers, midwives, and herbalists. Surpluses of grain and other goods were sold in nearby communities and in Salt Lake City. Within a few years, the community had achieved complete self-sufficiency. But even many years after the reality of the United Order had been confined to a future millennium, Mormon communities remained deeply committed to self-reliance and solidarity. During the Great Depression, the LDS Church began a massive effort to provide work and food for members of the church through its welfare program, which continues today. Ward and State farms and orchards are maintained by volunteer work, and many wards retain the cooperative enterprises such as soap making. These enterprises not only provide for the poor among us, they allow volunteers a sense of pride in hard work and solidarity with others. Now, to this day, the Mormon ward, as I've said, remains to an overwhelming degree a communitarian institution. And this paper is not meant to be a critique of that. The following, I'm going to go through a list of ideas and suggestions in sort of brainstorm style to begin to talk about ways in which this communitarian institution could be applied to resolving some of these global problems. The Mormon wards are geographically organized, and so we live, for the most part, fairly close together. And one of the solutions proposed for a host of global problems is that of localization. Ward members could begin to look at the resources within the ward boundaries and match them up with their own physical needs, moving toward an ethic of a more authentic self-reliance. So, for example, freecycle.org is a online community that was designed to promote and implement a gift economy. Groups create small listservs organized geographically, and then they submit emails with free stuff that they're giving away. No one's allowed to even barter or to sell anything on these sites. Everything that goes in through the filter of the site has to be either given away or taken for free. And that could be easily implemented on a ward or stake level. Another similar idea would be to form time banks or skill banks. Groups could track the hours worked and credited, and credits can be spent on services. So, for example, if Susie is babysitting for 3 hours, then she can spend that $3 or time dollars on getting a math tutor. Lists of skills could accompany these time banks so that each member's available skills would be accessible. And another form of this is called LETS, L-E-T-S, or Local Exchange Trading Systems, which are similar ideas that incorporate a central recording of goods and services exchanged but without the use of a currency. Skill banks could be used and could lead to cooperative ward projects such as soap making, jam, quilts, and clothing. Ward goals could be set for an area of self-reliance. A list of essential skills could be made, and members could volunteer to learn them. Baker, woodworker, beekeeper, etc. Bike repair workshops could encourage ward and community members to bike more and learn the basics of bike repair, even encouraging members to bike to church. Church committees could be expanded to tackle civic engagement, ethical consumption, and environmental stewardship. Wards could articulate, for example, the potential of Sundays as a protest against consumerism, which is basically a weekly buy-nothing day. This could also be applied to a weekly or monthly carbon fast no drive days, and really kind of taking seriously the idea of a Sabbath. Food production and consumption can be assessed and goals set through a ward food security committee. Yard fences could be torn down between neighbors. Abandoned lots could be taken over. Welfare farms redesigned. Wards could even adopt a local or regional farmer to fill in ward production gaps like grain, meat, dairy, modeled after the CSA model, which is the community-supported agriculture, the buying a share in a farmer's crop. This adoption model could also be applied to a ward in Latin America or Africa where members could sponsor a microcredit project or do fundraisers for specific projects. Wards could even send delegations to these villages. I'm sure there's plenty of return missionaries with suggestions of places where we could start. The last big idea is a large-scale project that's becoming more and more popular, which is called co-housing. Co-housing is a type of intentional community, some people like to call it a commune, where a group of people get together and purchase land or contiguous housing and create a master plan that is environmentally friendly and puts houses close together with cars on the periphery and common spaces and provides for garden plots. The group is legally a nonprofit or a limited liability corporation or a condominium association. So members can therefore own their own homes, but not necessarily the land that the homes are on. Co-housing has exploded in the last 5 years. There's a co-housing community here in Salt Lake called Wasatch Common. So that was just a short list of some of the ideas that ward structures could implement to more closely resemble some of the earlier ideals of the United Order and the Mormon communalism of the 19th century. So, thank you very much. These are our second panelists, Oliver. I already introduced you. They know all about you. And he's going to be talking next.
Okay, so I was asked to present about the greening the ward, and I think that and a lot of the ideas that Jason just shared are equally applicable to what I want to talk about. But when we're talking about greening something or implementing sustainability or making these kinds of changes, you know, why are we proposing this? And, you know, when we're talking about sustainability, what is it exactly that we'd like to sustain? Is it our jobs, our families, our communities, our economy? Is it the church? For that matter, what is it exactly that we have? And the question is, how good is it going to look when we dress our great-grandchildren in it? In the early spring of my senior year of high school, during my first prospective visit to the University of Utah, I was standing on top of the foothills on campus up there, and there was this incredible, blazing, hazy, gold-amber sunset, and I remember being just stunned and deeply impressed by it. And the irony was that when I came home, I learned that the only reason the sunset was that beautiful was because there's so much pollution and particulate matter in the air that it was refracting the sunlight in this way to create this, you know, just strange and almost otherworldly atmosphere. But such is our time, and it's the time of dire beauty. It's the sunset of a society basking in the warmth of sunlight, glinting off the exhausted heat from the last 200 years worth of fossil fuel booming growth. And yet at no time before has humanity had such a great opportunity if it's willing to engage in the prospect of laying the groundwork for what I'd like to call a full life for all children, a pathway beyond sustainability to a future that is whole. It's like we're standing atop a tall mountain, having only shortly arrived after a very fast ascent, but we know that we're not going to be able to proceed the way that we came up, and that while we're up there with all the encompassing view, we'll need to plan our descent and find the best route so that we don't lose people or our values along the way. But we have to use our time on the top wisely because we can see a storm coming, and we know that our time is limited. There's a Native American saying that goes, if you don't change your direction, you're going to wind up where you're headed. And also there's the one that says, what comes up must come down. And in ecology, one great example of this is the way the yeasts grow. When yeasts are put into solution with a dense energy source like sugar, their population explodes. It grows and peaks. And once their energy source starts to decline, their population declines dramatically and just as sharply as it grew, because they can't live in the solution of alcohol that they create from their energy source. And when you compare the growth curve of yeast to the growth curve of humanity after the discovery of fossil fuels and the Industrial Revolution, they're almost identical in the way that they climb to the peak. And last fall there was a group of physicians here in Utah called the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And they issued a statement in June or July stating that the air quality along the Wasatch Front had reached a crisis state. And the reason for our polluted air is twofold. First, that during the course of our lives, to get the places we go the way we do, to heat our homes the way we do, to power our lives the way we do, we produce waste, and often that takes the form of exhaust. And the second reason is that we live next to mountains. That's the reason we're here. And the mountains create inversions, which create our air quality crisis. The physicians' group stated that the acute air pollution we experience affects us in such a way that the average life expectancy of somebody living in the Wasatch Front is the same as that of a chain smoker. Our life expectancy is on average 2 years shorter than the average American. And, you know, as a people, we ought to see the irony in this. That as LDS people, we refrain from smoking, yet the way we live within our resources on our land has the same effect on our bodies as smoking. And I like to see it, the mountains, not as a curse, the inversions not as a curse, but as a blessing. We have, unlike many other people, mountains here to make us face the effects of our actions and say, you know, this isn't working for you and it's not working for nature either. It's in ecological systems, this is termed a negative feedback. And this is one local example of the kinds of problems humanity is facing in our time. And the global situation mirrors that of the local. Demand for oil, automobiles, electricity, and food continues to rise, and supplies are dwindling. So with this situation, there are several possible outcomes that are being discussed. And the first is that is the techno explosion as a solution, that we'll discover new energy sources and new technologies to mitigate the effects of our waste or the changing climate. And to me, this seems like the gambler's route, standing atop the mountain, eyeing other higher peaks in the face of the storm, trusting that the means that got us there will continue to power us and will allow us enough time to use our ingenuity to perpetuate our journey, continuing business as usual. The second is that what we hear from the dementors of doom, or the fear that resides in all of us, that with this crisis situation will come a collapse and disaster. The third is that of the green tech stability, that humanity will achieve a stable state and using our current resources and our technology to rebuild our society on renewable energy. And it's inspiring, yes, but with the approaching storm, we've got a lot of work to do and we're short on time. The fourth outcome, and I believe the most desirable, is that of the creative descent, or earth stewardship, and it's the one that recognizes that in nature, systems and populations fluctuate with their energy base, rather than maintaining a steady state, and has been called the prosperous way down. And some of the most animating proponents of this path beyond sustainability come from within the field of permaculture design, a design science aimed towards developing systems that integrate with and regenerate natural systems rather than degrading them. And in permaculture design, we learn that for human systems to work within nature, we have to look at them as an integral whole, not as separate parts of the same machine. And that the systems that we create have to care equally for the earth as for the people, and that they need to create abundance for all people. So taking the example of an LDS ward and using it to show how a community that, in the face of the declining energy and changing climate pressures, would become resilient, we would need to look at seven aspects of life. We'd start with, and a lot of these things are similar to what Jason was talking about in the agrarian communitarian roots that Mormonism comes from. And that's part of the strength that I believe that the church and the wards have to draw on. And the first aspect of life I'd like to talk about is where we most directly take our energy from our environment, which is our food and the way we treat the land we live on. And whereas in an industrial culture where food is produced in monocultures with large inputs of dense energy derived from petroleum or natural gas in the form of fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and is transported over great distances, the green ward would take a more energy-efficient approach and grow food where it is needed. A green ward would call or create a calling for somebody to be in charge of ensuring that enough food can be grown for the ward within its boundaries and that people can learn how to create gardens. I personally became interested in the issues surrounding sustainability through the very visceral path of my stomach. After 3 or 4 straight years as a university student, I was noticing that I didn't really know what to feed myself, and that despite the fact that I was trying to listen to my body and my cravings, I wasn't feeling satiated. But when I met my wife Raquel, who was a good cook and whose passion for food was contagious, and rubbed off on me quickly. I started reading cookbooks and eventually found one called Nourishing Traditions, which is a book that looks at how our food as a culture has changed over the last 100 years. And it teaches you how to prepare food like your great-grandmother or her indigenous cousin might have. And so the second aspect of community life of a green ward is the physical and spiritual health and well-being of the community. And there are great ways that we can learn to grow our food where we need it, but we have to relearn how to use it. A green ward would have an hour of Sunday school devoted to teaching children or families recipes from our ancestors from before the time of refined sugar, and then we'd cook a meal to share together at lunch with the ward and neighbors. And a green ward would extend their scrutiny of the kind of substances they let into their bodies, from food and drugs to the air they breathe and to the quality of their water, responding to negative feedback in the forms of pollutants promptly, protectively, and creatively. So the third aspect would be community governance. And this kind of response to pollutants or other types of problems that arise within a community has to rise up from the bottom. And to be effective, they need to be able to have the same kind of weight as the power that comes from the top of the community down. So the green ward would become a place of open dialogue and discussion. Conflict and disagreement would be allowed to manifest itself, but the community would learn to become skilled in conflict resolution. It increases tolerance for variety and experiences and increases capacity for compassion, leading to problems being not disregarded but cared for. And the fourth aspect of a green ward would be culture and education. And I've often observed within the church that people existing on the fringe of the mainstream, whether by choice or not, can be subjected to prejudice and discrimination, knowingly or unknowingly. And it can create a great deal of torment and pain in their lives, while people who feel at home with the majority of people are unaware that a problem is even going on. In permaculture, we learn that the fringe of an ecosystem is the most fertile and productive part of it, because it's where two or more ecosystems collide, and we learn to value it for the marginal, its difference and its abundance. And this is how the way that we prepare the way for our children for the prosperous way down is emphasizing an ethic of care for all people and their diversity, working with their health and well-being by emphasizing an ethic for care of the earth, learning and teaching ways to restore the earth as we procure our livelihoods from it, by learning how to create, live with, and share abundance rather than perpetuate a system of scarcity. In the last four aspects of a sustainable community or green ward are topics that Jason touched on in his paper about really communitarian and agrarian ideals, and the way that if we can localize, we can solve a lot of our problems. So as an overview, the fifth aspect would be the learning of new crafts, tools, and technology. The sixth would be using that increased knowledge of more traditional tools and technology to localize our economy and plug ways that our community wealth leaves the community. And the last aspect of... I'm missing one. No. Yeah, the last aspect of community life is in some ways the most intimidating because it's one of the largest, the built environment. And that's where most of our energy goes and is used on a daily basis. Working for an architecture firm, a few things I've learned is that although our cities and infrastructures seem immense and unchangeable, they're actually in constant flux. There are huge amounts of resources that go into demolition and rebuilding. There are many points where a change in design can go a long way, especially at this time of still abundant resources. An example of this is that by paying careful attention to the placement of windows in a home in relation to the path of the sun throughout the year, can reduce energy needs up to 70% without changing anything else in the design. If we choose to, we can design buildings that operate at a comfortable temperature throughout the year naturally, using only sun and natural ventilation. And really using an integrated and holistic approach to design and looking at our lives to relocalize our needs so that we can meet our needs within our communities, meet our financial and economic needs, our infrastructure really becomes less of a problem because we don't have to travel as far to get what we need. So this is a desirable story of the green ward that I'd like to paint. Some aspects of it might seem harder than others, but my invitation is for you to analyze the reasons you hold to and those that the church or its people holds to that make them seem hard. Consider whether those reasons are empowering or not, and if they're not, breathe the life that you put into them into a story that will make your life happier and healthier, into a life full of creativity and of abundance. Thanks.
My name is Zach Davis, and I'm from St. George. And it's good to have a lot of friends here to accompany me with this. I'm going to be speaking a little bit about how the church can be more culturally sensitive in the places that it is established. Last year, I spent some time living in India. I was in New Delhi, and the ward there was interesting for a lot of reasons. The first was that someone had decided not to teach the gospel in Hindi, and so all the church was conducted in English. This meant, though, that 3/4 of the church members had no idea what was going on at church, and so there would always need to be a translator translating what the few educated Indians or the Americans were saying. Translation, it's tough to really feel the spirit that way, and it was a really messed up situation. There was no, there just weren't materials in Hindi. It was very strange. And like I said, there was many Americans there, which isn't probably surprising to many who have been in foreign countries. The branch president, 6 elders, a senior couple, and a few expatriates made up about half of the congregation. So a very American place there, and it had a very American flavor, which is very strange because India is about the opposite place in the world to America. An interesting thing happened while I was there. We went to a big state conference or a big group conference, and a general authority was attending, and he publicly forbid the practice of arranged marriages, even among church members. And this really made a lot of church members confused and annoyed and angry because they saw nothing wrong with the institution as long as it was done within the church. It worked for them. It was culturally proper to the way that they saw the world. But the general authority actually said, do not do this. It's against agency. Thinking about my experiences there have led me to think that the church probably ought to reconsider certain ways that it goes forth in the world. Does the church suffer from its cultural insensitivity? Yes. The first way that it suffers is that wards have a decreased spiritual ability for spiritual power and regeneration within their congregations. Limiting the kind of dress, music, meetings, style, and form of the way that the church is presented creates a spiritual staleness because the core principles of the gospel are filtered through a particular cultural context. Local leaders are unable to innovate and to develop programs that might better fit their congregation and their cultural context. And so because of that, you have places like the New Delhi branch where I don't think there was there really was a layer of it was like a plastic wrap around the church that prevented breathing. It's the only way I can think of it. That the church leaders themselves, I mean, they were American too, and so they had their own ways. The local leaders didn't have the ability to come up with things that would suit them. It was really difficult for the church to grow there. And it's surprising because the church has been in India at least 15 years, maybe 20 years, and that branch was just tiny, you know, abysmally tiny. And it's not the fact that India doesn't like Christianity. There's lots of Christianity going on. So it's a problem. The second problem is it damages our missionary efforts. The church missionary effort is centralized, it's foreign heavy, it's slow to adapt to local customs and needs. Anyone looking carefully at church growth recognizes that it's not really growing anymore. There's as many people leaving it as coming in. In South America, there's only 2% of the members of the 2.5 million that are endowed. There's a lot of areas of concern for the way that the church is growing. I think part of the problem is that the church isn't very good at adapting to local needs. One helpful way of thinking about this is the difference between a world religion and a global church. One person has decided that a world religion is one that can adapt its core message to the rituals and thoughts of local populations, whereas a global church is one that may have members in many countries, but remains more fastened to the cultural context of its origin. I think it's pretty clear we're the latter. And I think it's also clear that we need to be moving towards the former if we want to continue to grow and to develop spiritually as a church. I came up with a few ways, I think, that we might think about how to make the church better able to adapt to local cultures. The first is a great pruning of church culture from core doctrine. I think that's been talked about a lot. Everyone's sort of aware that there's a core, but do we know what that core is, and have we effectively pruned yet? I don't think so. I think one helpful way of thinking about what our core doctrine is the Temple Recommend interview. I think that's pretty much basic. That's about all you need to be considered an active member of the church. And those questions, they're not very detailed, and there's not very many. And there's a lot of room for adaptation to local concerns. So what that would do is if we could get the church down to a more core message, it would allow, I think, greater flexibility on pretty much everything regarding the church, and especially as concerning church meetings. Besides sacrament and perhaps priesthood quorum, there's no reason why the meetings can't be different from place to place. And there's no reason why the church in different countries can come up with programs that suit them. They can come up with different music, again, different schedules, form styles, anything that can better match the needs of local congregations. As far as reforming the missionary program, one possibility is get rid of the outsourcing to young American missionaries and have all missionaries be local. Other centralized churches, such as Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists, they're also top-heavy, but they don't rely on one country the way that we do. They rely on local members, local missionaries. And because of that responsibility, I think it's more they do a more effective job of spreading their message. And trying to emphasize more on locally driven and locally led missionary efforts rather than, again, Western imports. It's a big task. I don't really think I have the answers. Part of this is to open discussion and get some of your ideas. But I think that there's a lot of room within the doctrine to adapt. I think it's just a matter of getting there. So I'll end there, and I guess I think we can just open up now for a discussion, including any one of the other talks. And maybe, I don't know, do we just call on people or do they come up?
Yeah, just tell them to come to the mic.
Yeah, just come up to the mic, and if you have a comment or a question or a suggestion for how we can address some of these issues, it would be great. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. I really enjoyed all three. I have a question for Zach specifically about the pruning and the core, I guess. And it's maybe two questions that I'll... And I'm just kind of curious. I feel like people have thoughts as well on the issue, but Zach specifically. On one, kind of what the effect... What the... how much... debates over apostasy, heresy, and orthodoxy in the church locally, so Salt Lake, Provo, Central and Northern Utah specifically, has affected the drive for standardization, you know, worldwide, and the ways in which efforts to, to purify or to use the same word, to prune, teaching of false doctrine or teaching of alternative doctrine, or even the alternative political movement within the church in this area has influenced a greater regimentation worldwide, maybe, than would have happened if there either were no controversies around here or if the controversies were handled differently. And I guess the second question related to it would be if attempts to prune church teaching to a core, what effects that would have on issues of dissent or let's say complex or ambiguous doctrine within the Mormon tradition.
Thanks, Tristan. So certainly the big question is, how do we remain orthodox? How do we remain pure? No one probably in Mormonism wants what the Anglicans are going through. And I think that's why we've overshot in a way to become even more rigid, because we don't want dissension. You give some freedom. I can just imagine some really popular Mormon preacher starting a church in Africa or something that's Mormon, but how orthodox is it? That's the great concern. I don't really know. I don't know a lot about the different heresies here in northern Utah and how that's affected it. I'm sure it has. Everything that happens here is magnified because the church leadership's here. So I'm certain, though, that there could be a mechanism for ensuring orthodoxy while allowing greater freedom. It might be a different mechanism we have. And that's something I would hope we can come up with. I don't know what it would be, though. I guess that's... Is there anything else?
Maybe a comment on that subject. I think the church started on a basis with Joseph Smith that was based on seek for truth. And Joseph Smith had an approach of really, he looked into many different religions, and there wasn't this need to get tied down to some truth that would never change, etc. He saw the truths that were around him, and I think he gathered them. I think I do have the same perspective that there is a core, but that doesn't go beyond the teachings of Christ. And I think if there was to be a core, it would be Christ's example. I do agree with the fact that we come to study the philosophies of the religion more than the teachings of Christ. For example, learning about the different kingdoms, everything that was about that, doesn't have to deal with human interactions on it. So I think where the church should go in the future is to really remain open, to let members, as it was at the foundation of the church, to let the members seek for truth and discuss things and stop fearing. There is a fear-based authority type of leadership that prevents members from looking. And because of this concept, as soon as someone has different ideas, the person is seen and the person feels as being in apostasy, which creates apostasy, which didn't exist at the beginning, because people could have questions, investigations, and not be seen as apostate.
Thank you, Natalie.
The best thing about this presentation is I just felt this surge of feeling like this is really possible, this isn't hard, because the structures, like Jason said, in the church are already in place, and there's such a rich system of social capital and of interaction and willingness to sacrifice and volunteer already. So I just had a few scattershot ideas. Number one, with your presentation, Zach, I think it would be really great if we had, as part of the missionary training program, an anthropology type of class that people could take and that could familiarize themselves with different beliefs and different ways of believing and methods of believing in different cultures, so that when they got to another culture, they weren't as likely to say, or if they were in their own culture, even they weren't as likely to say, oh, we don't do this. This isn't Mormonism, because they could understand better the process of coming to belief, respect it more, and allow for more creativity. Another thing I was thinking is that the hard thing, I think, for a lot of LDS people is that there is a potential for a lot of creativity in the ward or in the stake, but that a lot of people feel like, for various reasons, feel like it's not their position to come and say, hey, I have this really good idea, why don't we do this? So people serve really creatively and diligently within the structures that are already in place, but I think people who think, for example, the way that Jason does about something, aren't very likely to go and say, hey, this is my idea. So I think that it would be great for people here to go to their bishops and their Relief Society presidents and people like that and say, hey, we could have, and obviously develop it first so it's not just, you know, like really unorganized, but to go and say, like, let's have a church meeting and say what we would like our ward to be like and talk about the skills we would need to develop. And, for example, with Jason's talk, you could say, okay, what skills do we need in this ward to be self-reliant as a ward, and what could we do to do that, and who is willing to develop which skills and sign up for it and start a program for mentoring about how to do those things depending on the skills in the ward. And then the last thing I was going to say is I liked Oliver's comment about permaculture not just being a green ethic in terms of like the particular nature environment, but an ethic of openness. And I think we should, I mean, from having a panel earlier that I organized about mediation and having a professional mediator come and talk to parents, church leaders, and younger people, I thought that was a fantastic experience. And we could have somebody's calling be a mediator to mediate on a weekly or monthly or however often basis conversations between people on the board who have ideas or disagreements or thoughts that they feel like they can't express as much in church. And that could be a calling, and that could be something people could participate on in on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, on the discussion of this issue with correlation and local cultures versus trying to have unity, and you know, the purpose of correlation is obviously an attempt to unify people. But then the complaint is like, well, in local cultures there needs to be some sort of like local flavor, and I think that goes beyond just a problem, you know, modernly, but it sort of like represents a tension inherent in Joseph's ideas to begin with. Like when he, you know, sort of the message was that the heavens are open and we can receive visions and stuff, but yet in the early church when Hiram Page came forward with other revelations and stuff, it's I forget the section of the Doctrine and Covenants, but he basically, Joseph was like, you know, said against that, no, you know, the authority is me, I'm the one that's called as the prophet. And then similarly, like in the 121st section where he says, we know by sad experience that almost all men, when they're given power, they'll abuse that power, and yet he created this institution, this government, in which it was patriarchal and authoritarian. And so there's just sort of like this inherent tension and contradiction where he recognized the pitfalls of such a system to begin with, but yet he did that. And I'm not saying that negatively at all. I just think that's sort of like an inherent tension that we have to deal with. And so that's my thoughts on that. The question I had was, Oliver, in your presentation, you talked about the different ways of going about this, going about the problem. The first one you sort of said the techno explosion or something like that. Anyway, when you were talking about your final solution that you thought was the best way, I just sort of thought that wasn't necessarily exclusive of embracing like technological advance as we move forward. So I'm just wondering, like, for you in particular, what is the role of technology as we move forward trying to solve these problems?
Well, I think that the role of technology really has to serve, in permaculture design, there are three core ethics that guide all of the design decisions to maintain the health of the environment. And those are care of earth, care of people, and the share of abundance or share the surplus. And the role of technology is to increase our capacity to do productive work. And if the technology that we create, if that can be used while maintaining our ethics of caring for people and caring for Earth and creation of abundance rather than scarcity, then I would say that, you know, those are technologies that can be embraced and at the same time create Earth stewardship.
So. We still have one more.
Seems like you have some various interesting cross currents here. I'm curious on how you address them. For one thing, I hear the concern about the ward doing more of this and that. And I'm wondering, as the church really faces, as we're going today in today's age of communications and all the pressures of society, whether we really want to leave room where people don't necessarily want more. In other words, I've heard people say, I want it to be my religion, but not my culture. The idea is that if we're going to do more for the wards getting together and doing more and more, are we acting in a way against the very thought of individuality, creativity? In other words, do we face the problem in the church, especially in areas where there's concentrations of LDS people, that we really get into each other's lives too much? And therefore, the people want to say, I'd like to go and hear principles taught, but then the simplification of, I don't need to go to more meetings and more involvements, but rather take those and engage myself in life itself, because that's the purpose. So the idea that we go back to what we did in the agrarian times, I wonder, and yet can we solve some of the problems that you're concerned with by saying maybe our curriculum needs to be creative and revamped? Is there room to teach in the church that moral issues involve environmental issues, just as we were concerned years ago with the MX missile? Do the moral issues mean we teach more about concern for poverty and discrimination, and this becomes part of the curriculum so that people are taught to go out and do things and we inspire them that way? We're taught that the earth is a stewardship, and therefore that's just as important as other moral issues, and so we revamp our curriculum and become more creative. And then on the issue that you raise, because we can make this, it seems to be too complex, and that is that we always seem to confuse doctrine with tradition with culture. And we get them all confused, and we make something cultural into doctrine. And it seems to me a lot of it is just what we as Americans generally face, and other people, we just sometimes don't take time to understand people's cultures. And Americans generally can be bulls in the china shop when they're dealing with cultures. And so isn't this part of the curriculum and the education of missionaries and even our church leaders at the top of how to understand cultures and realize if someone wants to play a drum in a meeting in Africa, that's fine. Even if in the Wasatch Front, we don't think it's very good. It has nothing to do with doctrine. And so I'm wondering if we make things too complex, we allow flexibility that the member of the church who wants to come and be taught but not be enmeshed all the time, and have someone getting into their life too much. There's room for that, room for more creative teaching broadly. And part of our understanding curriculum and duty as Christians is to learn to understand people everywhere and incorporate that. I find actually the thought that the ward is going to do all these other things, I think a lot of people in today's digital age and communications and traveling, I personally think that maybe is perhaps going in the wrong direction, but adjusting all the trends we have today and how to really teach people back to the Spencer Kimball originally. Let's cut things down, let's teach people some good principles and encourage them to just go out and to do it.
you don't really have a whole lot of time to respond, but I appreciate those comments, and I'll just end real quickly. Maybe we can talk a little more afterwards. But my only concern with what you said, and I would agree that we don't want to take the existing institution and then throw six or seven more meetings on top of it. We're talking about taking a communal and communitarian institution and incorporating some of these values, like you're saying, into the principles, and that will hopefully naturally flow from our interactions. Because the irony of what you said is that individualism and kind of atomism and everyone doing their own thing has a lot to do with the problems that we're in the first place. And people who live and feel isolated from community and don't know what to do with their lives are begging for this stuff. That's why we see the rise in farmers markets and communal experiments and co-housing and cooperatives. All these things are resurging because of that need that Mormonism takes for granted, which is a robust social network. And so we're not... I wasn't suggesting that we need to make it more complex and more time-consuming, but simply to incorporate, like you're saying, some of these other moral principles into our existing communitarian structures. So we can talk more. We got to get out of this room. I think there's another panel. So thank you all so much for coming.